The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, this issue of the Reader's Digest is kind of interesting because they're celebrating their 100th anniversary. That's kind of interesting because they started the same year that my Lions Club, Durham Lions Club, started. 100 years. Before there was a magazine, there were stacks of 3x5-inch slips of paper onto which Reader's Digest founder DeWitt Wallace would jot notes and quotes from everything he read. After he returned from serving in World War I, Wallace decided to share his condensed version of articles. He and his wife, Leela Alice Atchison Wallace, worked together on the first issue of Reader's Digest, published in February 1922, and many others afterwards. We continue their mission of sharing amazing stories with our millions of readers. For more looks backs and ahead, turn the pages, which we shall do, onward for another century and beyond. The Little Magazine Big Stories. A look at the significant, memorable, prescient articles and authors from 100 years of Reader's Digest. There is an interesting graphic of what looks like a feathered pen doing different designs. By our very rough calculations, Reader's Digest has published some 35,000 articles in nearly 1,200 issues. Our century-long table of contents features stories of every stripe, from short essays to sprawling books excerpts. And that's not counting all the jokes, anecdotes, and other elements that help make what DeWitt Wallace called his little magazine. These small pages have held some very big names, including U.S. presidents, first ladies, world leaders, poets, comedians, sports legends, musicians, inventors, and indeed, the biggest contributors of all, everyday Americans with a story to tell. These are some of our proudest moments. How to keep young mentally. DeWitt Wallace didn't finish college, but he never stopped learning. The first article in the first issue highlighted inventor Alexander Graham Bell and his belief in lifelong learning. The first essential of any real education is to observe. Observe, remember, compare. It was an apt beginning reflecting our self-educated founder's endless curiosity. Does tobacco enter the human body? By Irving Fisher from Dearborn Independent, November 1924. As the 20s roared on, Americans found even more reasons to light up. While doctors appeared in ads extolling the benefits of certain brands of smokes, Reader's Digest was blowing the whistle. The story cites a study that found smoking is one of the most very significant reasons why fewer men than women attain old age. Our drumbeat warning continued with anti-smoking articles through the decades, including Jehul Hook's The New Generation from the New York Times in May 2020. Cigarette advertising on TV and radio was outlawed in 1971, and print ads were later restricted, but that didn't affect R&D's bottom line, because the magazine had never accepted tobacco ads. Funnily enough, R&D's persistent coverage of the ills of tobacco is the primary plot line in Mad Men's pilot episode. Bread by Deluxe, J.D. Ratcliffe, December 1939. Margaret Rutkin had been baking bread for her allergy-prone son in 1937, grinding wheat in a coffee mill to preserve the bran and B vitamins lost in commercial flour. After this article about the success of her small business, so many readers wanted a slice that Rutkin borrowed $15,000 to move to a larger location. To buy her bread today, look for Pepperidge Farm on grocery shelves. Leela and DeWitt Wallace's. In the 2020s have Jack Dorsey, the 1920s had the Wallaces. The founders of Reader's Digest and world's first content curators collected the very best in print, condensing it all into the Reader's Digest version. The Doctor of Lennox by A.J. Cronin, September 1939. And while my last name is Cronin, I'm not related to A.J. In our enduring series, My Most Unforgettable Character, contributors wrote about the person who made the biggest impact on their lives. For Cronin, who wrote the first in the series, it was his shy boyhood friend Carrie, who became a well-respected country doctor. Other unforgettables include baseball manager Branch Rickey by Jackie Robinson, Thomas Edison by his son Charles Edison, Eleanor Roosevelt by journalist Edmund Bugby, and Chuck Jones by his cartoon creation Bugs Bunny. And Sudden Death by J.C. Furnace in August of 1935. The editors note at the beginning of the issue sets up this graphic account of the preventable carnage of car wreck. Like the gruesome spectacle of a bad automobile accident itself, the realistic details of this article would nauseate some readers. Within 3 months, 4 million reprints of the story had been handed out with license plates at motor vehicle departments around the country. The New York Times later calls it perhaps the most widely read magazine article ever published anywhere. That's interesting. Surprise Endings by Anthony Abbott from The True December 1945. The first drama in real life told the story of Il Diavolo, a Chicago mob boss who bizarrely lost 50 pounds in a prison hunger strike. Diavolo believed he was light enough to his hanging. His accomplice could revive him. Police found a doctor, nurse, and medical supplier in the hearse. Fiction writers, of course, do not tell such tales, because who would believe them, wrote Abbott. That's interesting. Tunnel to Freedom by Flight Lieutenant Paul Brickell, Royal Australian Air Forces, as told to Alan I. Mickey in December 1945. The Great Escape. 76 Allied prisoners sprung themselves from a German POW camp by digging a 336 tunnel under a stove. The tale became a 1963 film starring Steve McQueen and Richard Attenborough. By the 1950s, we've begun to illustrate our articles, and there's a picture here of a page called The Crime of the Century, and there's two men standing there with a map in the background. Crime of the Century by J. Edgar Hoover, May 1951. The head of the FBI reconstructs how the criminals who stole atomic bomb secrets from the United States were apprehended. John Steinbeck. The June 1964 book section excerpts The Travels with Charlie, Steinbeck's last book before his death in 1968. The work chronicles his road trip with his trusty poodle, Charlie. According to Steinbeck's son, the author knew he was dying and wanted to see his country one last time. From start to finish, I found no strangers. If I had, I might be able to report them more objectively. But these are my people, and this is my country. Mr. Muhammad Speaks by Alex Haley, March 1960. Our new contributing editor was the first to write for a major national publication about the Nation of Islam, its leader Elijah Muhammad, and brash young spokesman Malcolm X. This laid the groundwork for the autobiography of Malcolm X, ghostwritten by Haley. The Girl Who Was Anne Frank by Louis de Jong in 1957. The director of the Netherlands State Institute for War Documentation told of Anne Frank's life before she and her family went into hiding, adding often overlooked context to her famous diary. Her father, Otto Frank, didn't want it published, but when friends pointed out that his daughter had wanted to publish a book about the annex, he agreed. "Oh, Mr. Frank," wrote one American girl, "she is so much like me that sometimes I do not know where myself begins and Anne Frank ends." Dark Yesterdays, Bright Tomorrows by Martin Luther King, from the book Strength Through Love in June 1968. Prophetic words, both poignant and powerful, were excerpted from Martin Luther King Jr.'s collection of sermons as the country reeled from his assassination. I Am Joe's Heart by J.D. Ratcliffe in April of 1967. I'm certainly no beauty. I weigh 12 ounces, am red, brown in color, and have an unimpressive shape. I am dedicated slave of, well, let's call him Joe. Joe is 45, ruggedly good-looking, has a pretty wife, 3 children, and an excellent job. Joe has it made. So began the first article of the popular health series that would continue until 1990, in which readers heard detailed accounts from 36 body parts of Joe and his female counterpart, Jane. Joe and Jane appeared in the articles over 4 decades. That's pretty impressive. Irma Bombeck. Irma Bombeck's writing career began modestly. One of her earliest columns appeared in the Dayton Shopping News. But when the beloved author needed a kidney transplant in 1996, no fewer than 30 readers volunteered theirs. Alas, no matches. Bombeck is also responsible for some of the funniest headlines to appear on our pages, including, "If Life is a Bowl of Cherries, What Am I Doing in the Pits?" and 65 Million Women But My Husband, May 1980. Our Haunted House on the Hudson, by Helen Herdman Ackley, May 1997. This spirited account of the ghostly companions residing in her family home came back to haunt the author when her home buyer got spooked. The now-famous Ghostbusters case determined that failing to disclose that a house is haunted might be a legitimate reason for a buyer to back out of a deal. The first came this article from the Betty Ford Center, "I Intend to Make It," by Betty Ford with Chris Chase from the book Times of My Life, February 1969. First Lady Betty Ford was putting the finishing touches on her autobiography, The Times of My Life, which was to be co-published by the Reader's Digest Association, when she discovered that the real ending had yet to be written. forwarded to a rehab facility to treat her alcohol and prescription drug addiction, then bravely shared her story. In her own memoir, Barbara Bush wrote of her fellow First Lady, "She transformed her pain into something great for the common good. Because she suffered, there will be more healing. Because of her grief, there will be more joy." Return of a Runaway Child by Gary Turbak in November of 1982. Georgia teenager Tammy Headley recognized one of the missing children in a July 1982 Reader's Digest article, "Missing 100,000 Children a Year" from Kiwanis Magazine. As Tammy Ann Pickerman, a nurse's aide who worked alongside her mother, the story in Headley's eagle eyes would soon reunite Pickerman, real name Mary Wavy Batson, with her family who had spent 2.5 years looking for her. Maya's Journey Home by Maya Angelou from the book I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, September 1982. Creativity is all of a piece, beginning in childhood. Some terrible and wonderful things happened in Stamps, Arkansas, to Maya Angelou as a little girl. There, as she relates in How I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, her nascent creativity was first threatened and then forged, reads an introduction by PBS host Bill Moyers. This expert reveals how Angelou and her classmates, feeling disrespected by a guest speaker at their high school graduation, proudly joined together for Lift Every Voice and Sing. Chappaquiddick, Still Unanswered Questions by John Barron in February 1980. In November 1979, Senator Edward Kennedy was poised to see the Democratic nomination for president from incumbent Jimmy Carter. Then came this story, which recounted in shocking detail a 1969 car accident that left campaign mirror worker Mary Jo Kopechne dead, contradicting Kennedy's account. Barron, a Navy intelligence officer and Cold War spy turned investigative reporter, joined Reader's Digest Washington, D.C. Bureau in 1965 and filed more than 100 articles before his retirement. And many people believe that the story blew Ted Kennedy's comeback with good reason. I've Come to Clean Your Shoes by Madge Hurrah from Guidepost, December 1983. What to do when a family is mourning? Show up and help. The morning of a family funeral, an acquaintance shows up unannounced and says, "I've come to clean your shoes." He spends the day quietly shining every pair in the house. The writer ends with this: "Now, whenever I hear of an acquaintance who has lost a loved one, I try to think of one specific task that suits that person's need, such as washing the car, taking the dog to the kennel, or house sitting during the funeral. And if the person says, 'How did you know I needed that done?' I reply, 'It's because a man once cleaned my shoes.'" I Still See Him Everywhere by Richard Morselli with Joe Cordor, July of 1984. After Richard Morselli's 13-year-old son, Todd, was killed by a drunk driver, the broken-hearted dad spoke honestly and graphically about the incident of students at Riverdale County School in New York City. "This was our sixth article in 4 years to warn of the dangers of drunk driving, and it led to a national campaign in which we offered $500,000 in scholarships to high school students who developed the programs that best promoted sober driving. We regularly railed against the dangers of drunk driving." John Updike, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning, frequently graced our pages. Pulitzer Prize winner frequently graced our pages. In February 1997, we published Paranoid Packaging from The New Yorker, sharing Updike's commentary on one of America's most vexing issues, how increasingly hard it is to open things. All this time, childproof pill bottles have been imperceptibly toughening and complicating, to the point where only children had the patience and eyesight to open them. Strange Encounter in Coho Creek by Morris Irwin in May of 1987. A prospector spends days camping in the Alaskan wilderness, working hard to earn the trust of a mother wolf, stared in a trap before she and her four pups starved to death. Eventually, he is able to free her. 4 years later, he encounters a wolf in the same meadow. Yes, the same wolf. When we shared this classic on RD.com in 2019, I remember that, it went viral and now has been read by many millions online and in print. Not in Our Town by Edward Dobb, November of 1994. When a spate of anti-Semitic vandalism swept Billings, Montana, the residents stuck back by placing a menorah in the windows of every home in town. Their actions were inspired by King Christian of Denmark, who was said to have instructed his citizens to wear the Star of David after Nazis ordered Jewish citizens to wear them. The Billings show of solidarity ignited the Not in Our Town movement, an effort that continues today, helping community leaders around the country fight intolerance and create safe, inclusive communities. Papa Was an American by Lou Buscaglia, February 1992. The quintessential immigrant story tells of Rocco Buscaglia, who landed in the United States in 1911 and was enthusiastic about becoming American as he was about being born an Italian. His son Leo grew up to be a renowned self-help author who praised the power of relationship and earned the honorary title of Dr. Love. How honest are we? We Lost Wallace with Cash and Contact Inside Info. How Honest Are We by Ralph Kenny Bennett, December 1995. Our famous wallet drop set up the ultimate test of honesty. If we left wallets in city around the country, how many would be returned? Well, over half, it turned out, 67%. The most honest city, Seattle, whose upstanding residents returned 9 out of 10 wallets. We repeated the experiment internationally with less impressive results. Just 47% of the wallets were returned. Horror in the Heart Lawn by Henry Hurt, May 1996. Henry Hurt, who had been a Reader's Digest editor-at-large since 1971, reported on everything from espionage to national disasters. But his favorite subjects were the poignant stories of people when the human spirit shone through circumstances that seemed hopeless. Hurt was able to combine these themes when he described the life and capture of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy J. McVeigh and the lives of some of the victims and the lasting effects on the family, rescuers, and survivors of what remains the worst act of terrorism carried on U.S. soil by an American. P.J. O'Rourke, the beloved satirist, is unafraid to challenge core American values, from Why the Beach is for the Birds, July-August 2017, to the two-party system in This Point to Ponder. The Democrats are the party that says government will make you smarter, taller, richer, and remove the crabgrass on your lawn. The Republicans are the party that says government doesn't work, then they get elected and prove it. That's very good. The Nicest Place in America, November 2017 to November 2021. In 2017, Reader's Digest launched our Nicest Places in America contest, a nationwide search for places around the country where people come together and kindness and civility win, even in the face of challenges. Our Nicest Places through the years were Gallatin, Tennessee, 2017, Yassin's Falfala House in Knoxville, Tennessee, 2018, Columbiana, Ohio in 2019, Buchanan, Michigan in 2020, The Quality of Life, Quality Inn in Kodak, Tennessee in 2021. For the past 5 years, Evrita has inspired us, nominating thousands of towns, neighborhoods, stories, and even front porches with stories that demonstrate the best of humanity. And we're ramping up for 2022's Nicest Place in America. Nominate your favorite place at rd.com/nicest. We might add it to our list. 3 out of the 5 nicest places are in Tennessee. Wow. Runaway Train by William Hendricks, March 2002. Through an improbable series of events, a locomotive carrying 200 tons of molten phenol barrels down a busy railroad at 50 miles per hour, with no conductor at the helm, doomed to crash once it reaches the residential town of Kenton, Ohio. Can a seasoned conductor and the new guy catch it? The many may already be spoiled if you saw the 2000 film Unstoppable, starring Denzel Washington and Chris Pine, inspired by this story. And yes, they did. Amy's Choice by Rena Dichter LeBlanc, September 2000. A 19-year-old fights for and eventually wins custody of her 4 younger siblings, managed to keep the family together after a drug-addicted mother landed in prison. The story spurred hundreds of donations for the family from our readers, and we're lapped into a lifetime movie, Gracie's Choice. Laughing matters. Humor connects us to one another, but how is it that we find funny changed over the past 100 years? Making people laugh connects us to one another, but what humor endures? For me, it's personal, life stories and experiences. Life, twisted and molded until you find the funny, will always evolve and therefore endure. I found that the closer it cuts to the bone, the funnier it is. The beauty of life is that everyone is similar in some way. While that may not have the same experiences, everyone can relate to observation on life, family, and the varieties of behavior we all encounter every day as we go about life. Humor is very helpful in one's everyday life. It can end tense situations. In my life, humor has ended arguments at home on too many working sets to mention. Finding the humor can break tension immediately. My dad was a rabbi, and he found humor so important during his sermons. it always broke the ice and brought the congregation together. At home, being phony brought the family closer. Jerry Seinfeld once told me how his dad collected jokes in a box. He would write them down on cards so he wouldn't forget them and then tell jokes at the dinner table. I could relate to that. My older brother, Fishy, used to bring home joke books and read them to me when I was 10 or 11 years old, and it had a great impact on me. Why do you want to make other people laugh? I asked Judd Apatow this once, and he said making other people laugh was an instant way to know you think I'm okay. That sounds about right to me. It's a bonding experience. Laughter is good for your health, and most important is just being able to laugh at yourself. Great comedians look at the prism of life in different ways. For instance, Chris Rock can always tell a relatable story about life and it will be funny. It will resonate with the audience and Chris will get a huge laugh. Steve Martin or Jerry Seinfeld will look at a similar observation in life and tell a very different story from a different angle and a very different delivery. Comedians look at life through a giant prism and they each look at that prism from a different angle. The best of them keep working it out until they find the humor that suits them and strikes the right chords and hopefully the laughter chord of an audience. People will always relate to the human story with all its challenges. The good thing about life is that it changes and evolves. Many of the issues and characters change. Humor has a natural way of evolving. Life itself never gets old and is always fodder for a laugh. Robin Williams, when talking about his mother, said, "She was a Christian Scientist. I used to tell her a Christian Dior Scientist." Then there were the Catskills comics, such as Alan King, Henny Youngman, and Ball Z. Lawrence, who all had so much fun with humor about family life. Henny Youngman's great line, "Take my wife, please," perfect and relatable and funny for the time. Politics was an important source of material for me. By the way, this is by David Steinberg. Politics was an important source of material for me, especially the Nixon era, his mannerisms, his duplicity of all of it. The Nixon years were a fun and fruitful part of my career. I was just a comedian. I had no idea I was even on Nixon's radar, but it turns out I was on his enemies list. That was shocking to me. I shared a lot of Nixon material with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. I guess Nixon was listening. Rumor has it, but humor has to adapt with modern life. As a result, comedians are constantly pushing the envelope. They have to, because what the previous generation found funny becomes a cliché to the new generation. As economy evolves with life, the edge keeps moving as well. As groundbreaking and revolutionary as Lenny Bruce was in his time, he feels tame compared to Richard Pryor. George Carlin pushed the boundaries of humor with 7 words you can never say on television, but I believe we say most of them now. That's what time does to comedy, and now with a whole new generation and the challenge is the same. Humorists must keep pushing that envelope, and we will. My hope for comedy is that we don't become comedy cops, and we just focused on being funny and pushing that moving envelope. Comedy will endure, it must, as long as the edge keeps moving forward. Go with laughter. A quote from Tina Fey. Live every week like it's Shark Week. A man down the street says that his wife is such a poor driver that the police gave her a season ticket. Movie cowboys mystify me, says Bob Hope. How can they jump off a porch roof and onto a horse and still sing in a normal voice? I often wondered that myself. The latest appliance on the market is a combination record player and air conditioner. It's designed for people who really like to play it cool. Reader's Digest saved my life. Grateful readers recount how our magazine got them diagnosis, treatment, and most importantly, their lives back. Before Dr. Google, there was the Dr. Reader's Digest. The public's leading source of medical information is the influential Duke's psychologist Kelly Brownell, Ph.D., called Reader's Digest in a 2009 study. Indeed, millions of people might read one of our health articles and then, when a mysterious symptom raises questions, recall its advice and be alerted to act. Sometimes they're even able to help inform their doctors. When we ask readers how this magazine had influenced their lives, the response included very specific, vivid tales of how, in their words, Reader's Digest saved my life. These are some of the stories they shared. When doctors were stumped, this article helped our reader find out what was wrong. I yelled at my husband, "This is what I have." Deborah Barber of East Philadelphia, East Pharsalia, New York, after reading in 2000 an article about a patient being diagnosed with achalasia. The condition causes 1 in 100,000 people mysterious, excruciating indigestion and vomiting. Barber had surgery the next week. My family was amazed that I found out what was wrong in Reader's Digest after years of going to 5 different doctors, she says. I was starting to drive away after visiting a friend when her mom ran out to our car. I just want to thank you again, she said. Big Bob has lived 20 more years because of you. It was because of Reader's Digest, too. I remember the incident like it was yesterday. My friend and I were watching TV in their basement when we heard a thud. Her dad had fallen and was mumbling incoherently. Her mom didn't want to trouble the doctor so late, but I was thinking I read about all his symptoms in an RD stories about strokes. When my friend said I was worrying them for nothing, I questioned myself. But the symptoms were there. Her mom finally called the doctor and discovered that Bob's blood pressure was off the charts. My advice, stick to your guns. It was a stroke. Andrea Hess, Brunswick, Maine. In 1994, the National Stroke Association said her article will literally be saving hundreds of lives. Cigarettes were killing me. I had a chronic hacking cough and would never clear my throat. When I had a scary heart episode, to calm myself, I had a smoke. Crazy, huh? Then my Reader's Digest arrived, with an article that suggested to quit smoking, you should breathe deeply, as if you were taking a draw of a cigarette. It worked. I stopped cold turkey the next day. I'm sure it saved my life. Rita Chapman Block, Houseville, Alabama. My health advice is to pray and pick up a Reader's Digest. J.P.B. of Oldowata, Tennessee, who helped his mother's doctors diagnose her mini-strokes by showing an article that prompted them to discover a congenital flaw in her heart and perform life-saving surgery. When my husband and I first married, he started complaining of feeling foggy-headed and having a metallic taste in his mouth. Then I came across the Reader's Digest article about fish fog, mercury poisoning from too much fish. It clicked. His favorite snack was tuna salad. He cut out the tuna and his fog lifted. I hate to think what might have happened if I hadn't read that article. Jennifer Masseter Lee in New Hampshire. My eyes had chronic broken blood vessels. One woman suffered for 14 years with various mysterious symptoms until she read this article, and there's a picture of her. My eyes had chronic broken blood vessels. The skin on my arms tore at the littlest bump. My hair fell out, and coarse black hair began growing on my face, thighs, and arms. Warts covered my fingers and the heels of my feet. I started gaining weight at an alarming rate. I was tested for von Willebrand disease, a blood disorder similar to hemophilia. Negative. My thyroid was tested. Negative. The symptoms continued to pile up. After 14 years, I consulted 5 different physicians, all of them stumped. Our Reader's Digest arrived in the mail, and as I read Misdiagnosed, the cover story about a woman with Cushing's disease, I knew this was me. My symptoms match hers. I went straight to my doctor's office and gave her the article. She told me that Cushing's was very rare, and she didn't think I had it. I started crying. My doctor said it couldn't hurt to test me. My results came back. I had a pituitary tumor and Cushing's, just like the woman in the story. I had brain surgery and am now an active and healthy 66-year-old. Thank you. I am forever grateful. Diva Andrews, Thousand Oaks, California. I was born in Pittsburgh in 1945, and the doctors didn't know why I was dying. My mother asked about the Rh baby stuff she'd read in Reader's Digest. She knew she was Rh negative, but for some reason the doctors didn't. When my parents heard that news, they got a doctor involved who happened to be doing research on Rh factor, and she saved me. My mother always told everyone the story on how Reader's Digest saved my life. I'm supposedly the oldest Rh baby in the world. Peggy Hans, Rockville, Maryland. Some of the most poignant letters we got tell of how a story saved a child's life. I was pregnant with my first child and having terrible headaches and nausea. My OBGYN couldn't see me until the following week, and I couldn't Google symptoms because it was before the Internet. I called my dad about my symptoms, and he said, I just read an article in Reader's Digest. It sure sounds like you have toxemia or preeclampsia. My dad demanded I go to the ER. I did and was promptly admitted with drumroll. Preeclampsia. I almost died. But instead, I gave birth to a boy 2 months premature. I had one more child, a daughter, who was also born premature due to toxemia. If R&D hadn't printed that story, my dad wouldn't have read it. I would have waited a week to seek medical attention, and I would likely not be here to email you. Leslie Bowman, Missoula, Montana. Suicidal thoughts came, but when I read your story, you told me that it will end. Michael Nino Ramirez of Quezon City, Philippines, writing to the editor Bully Monday, whose first-person article of recovering from panic attacks was published in international editions of the Reader's Digest. Your story came out in 2018, but it saved me in 2020, Ramirez told her. You encouraged me to face my fears. Miraculously, his airway cleared. My wonderful son lived, and now he's a doctor. Judy Hoopman of Fredericksburg, Texas, describing how her 2-year-old son was choking when she remembered reading about the brand new Heimlich maneuver and frantically applied the technique. I was 11 months old. The bathtub had only 6 inches of water. My mother left me to warm my bottle and returned to find me face down in blue. She remembered in Reader's Digest that you could blow air into drowning victims, which she did. A recent immigrant, she subscribed to improve her English, and after that she swore to subscribe for the rest of her life. Another woman saved a child in Sausalito, California, when she remembered the same article. The Day My Son Drowned, August 1958. Monica Inster, Manchester, Connecticut. Anti-smoking since 1942, R&D was one of the earliest critics of big tobacco. My teacher read What Cigarette Commercials Don't Show to Us. It's by a 44-year-old man with a throat cancer due to smoking. He described his horrifying hospital stay, his wife's pain, his children's pain, and the battle to save his voice, which he loses along with the larynx and pharynx. He also describes the beautiful people in the smoking ads on TV. All of the people in my family were smokers, not me. Every time I wanted to smoke, I reread the article. Many years later, I taught biology and read it to my students. I told them if they were ever tempted to smoke, to remember what I read them. Elise Vito, Lawrence, New York. Okay, we're going to switch over to Consumer Reports now. And I mentioned last week that they were kind of interesting because in the January Consumer Reports, there was an article for a better night's sleep to try this. And in the February, there's how to get the sleep you really need. So I'm going to read both these articles in succession so that we can get a better feel of how to sleep. And considering I had a heck of a time last night falling asleep, I can really identify with this. What 2 weeks with 6 wearable trackers taught me about getting more Z's by Alan St. John. Night 1. Total sleep 7 hours and 44 minutes. Sleep performance score 88. REM sleep 2 hours and 1 minute. That's what the smartphone app on my Whoop 3.0 fitness tracker told me about how I slept my first night of evaluating wearable sleep trackers. The positive stats were at odds with what I scribbled in my handwritten sleep log on moments before. I woke up feeling like death warmed up. Welcome to the promising and sometimes confusing world of personal sleep tracking. Since the beginning of the pandemic, my generally solid sleep had become more fitful. After trying the easy stuff, buying cheap, squishy down pillow, and asking my golden retriever Rugby to stop snoring, I turned to technology. Because I'm a tech editor at Consumer Reports, I planned a deep dive as part of our Outside the Labs program to find a device that would help me understand my disrupted slumber and maybe even sleep better. Wearable sleep trackers are part of the $30 billion sleep improvement market that has taken on added momentum during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Sleep Foundation named the disruption Coronasomnia. Available in a wide range of shapes and sizes, wearable trackers claim to monitor many of the same metrics as laboratory sleep studies prescribe for people with insomnia or other sleep disorders. Evaluations like those usually involve an overnight stay at a clinic wearing an array of sensors. Today's consumer-grade trackers are relatively inexpensive, rechargeable devices that may use your movement to log sleep duration, sleep stages like physically restorative deep sleep, or rapid eye move, REM, in which most dreaming is done, or the number of times you awaken at night. Most devices roll that into a sleep score. But as I looked at the numbers on my phone, it seemed equal parts problem and promise. Shall I embrace the stats that told me I slept fine, or give in to my can't-go-back-to-bed feeling? The answer I came to realize was that I needed to spend less time fretting about sleep data and more time thinking about the devices themselves. People buy these things thinking that a weight loss program, Michael Gardner, Ph.D., director of the Sleep Research Program at the University of Arizona, told me, but they're usually more of a bathroom scale. That sage advice helped me come to grips with sleep trackers and ultimately to select an editor's choice model. To begin with, I consulted with 5 sleep doctors and researchers who helped me narrow the field to 6 models. The Apple Watch Series 6, Fitbit Charge 4, Garmin Vivo Smart 4, Muse S Headband, ORA Ring, and Whoop 3.0 strap. I wore all 6 at once for 14 nights. At the end of 2 weeks, I poured my data into a 6-page, 16-column spreadsheet. Consumers can sip Excel and just see the data on their smartphone apps. But when I took a step back from the raw numbers, I realized the most important takeaways from this experience were actually quite simple. The first revelation was that the devices that were comfortable during the day could be downright annoying at night. I found the Whoops 3.0 strap scratchy, while those on the Fitbit Charge 4 and the Apple Watch seem either too loose or too tight. The narrow band on the baby blue Garmin Vivo Smart 4 irritated my skin, and the Muse S headband flat out kept me awake. The Aura Ring? I hardly noticed it. The other big takeaway, don't get distracted by the data. At first, I looked at the previous night's results right after writing in my sleep diary. That led me to go to bed earlier in an attempt to juice my scores. The net result was more time in bed, but not more actual sleep. Unlike so many things, sleep doesn't respond to sheer effort. No one has ever slept longer or better trying harder, Grant Gardner, who consults with Fitbit, told me, a little too late. I also began obsessing over minor data discrepancies. On night 13, for example, the Fitbit warned me that I had logged only 5 hours and 50 minutes. The Garmin, meanwhile, congratulated me on Susie for 7 hours, 36 minutes. With sleep stages, the devices varied even more. It turns out I was worrying over nothing. My expert explained that sleep science can feel madly inept to consumers. The algorithms on each device differ a little in how they track the micro-awakenings that litter even a good night's sleep, which meant that I shouldn't freak out if the stats said I only got 7 hours or less of REM or deep sleep than the night before. There's a general notion that you need to get 8 hours of sleep, but really it depends on the person, says Molly Atwood, Ph.D. and offensive professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Getting less than 6 hours sleep a night is not great. Week-to-week trends, she says, are what you should watch. As for sleep staging, people ask me about sleep stages, but honestly, I don't care much about them, says Gardner. While consumer-grade devices are improving, he explains most of them are at their weakest when measuring REM and deep sleep. And reasonably healthy sleepers tend to regulate their own sleep stages pretty effectively without any effort. You can make yourself get more REM sleep, says Dimitri Gavilov, a sleep meta researcher at the University of Oxford in England. A few days after I ended my evaluation, I realized my answer was right in front of me. While I was happy to shed most of the trackers after 2 weeks, I had forgotten to take off the Aurora Ring. This elegant device wins my editor's choice award because of how easy it slips into the background. It's a light, ring-style band that's sized like a piece of jewelry. I found it comfortable enough to wear it 24/7. On the data font, there's no display, so I could pretend that Aurora was a dumb device. That meant I went to the Robust app, not when prompted by a teaser stat on a device's screen, but whenever I had the time and inclination to absorb the auras. That's, by the way, that's O-U-R-A. Granular sleep inflow. I began using my Aura as my bathroom scale, a companion that became part of my everyday routine. It serves as a gentle but persistent reminder about good sleep habits, while keeping me from obsessing over them. In the end, I started sleeping like I did before the pandemic, and I learned a simple but powerful lesson. The best sleeper trapper is the one you can ignore. Some better sleep tricks. Turn on your tracker's insight into Sweet Dreams and find the following. Keep a diary. A sleep tracker makes it fun and easy to keep track of how much you slept. But it's also important to know how well you slept, which is why many sleep doctors suggest that patients also keep a sleep diary. Entries can include when you ate and exercised and how you felt when you woke up. That weird dream with Tom Hanks riding a llama? Totally optional. Wind down. Sleep trackers often offer settings to remind you to spend time unwinding before bed. To do this, turn off electronics, some apps can even limit your notifications, and begin a ritual that might include a hot bath and a good book. Avoid evening snacks, caffeine, and alcohol, and settle down in a cool, dark, comfortable room. Dialogue with your doctor. If you're not sleeping well, don't hesitate to see your doctor and share the data from your tracker. Insomnia can often be remedied without medication or invasive procedures, and the gold standard treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy, which involves building better bedtime habits, can help you in as little as 6 sessions. And here's a description of the different trackers. Comfort, Value, and Sleep Insight, how each of these 6 devices performed outside CR's labs. Apple Watch Series 6 costs $350. The Apple Watch is a bit of a paradox. It sports a Swiss Army knife-like range of functionality, from tracking workouts to answering phone calls. That said, its sleep tracking features are quite rudimentary, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Instead of a detailed breakdown of sleep stages, the Apple Watch provides a big-picture look at your sleep habits. Apple recently introduced a Series 7 watch with a larger display and charging that's claimed to be slightly quicker, but no real changes that should affect the sleep tracking functions. The best feature, the app shows 2 weeks of sleep data and helps me identify trends. Biggest drawback, with only about 18 hours of battery life, the Apple Watch requiring a fine time during the day for charging. Best for the Apple farm who's interested in but not obsessed with sleep. Claimed battery life 18 hours. Fitbit Charge 4 for $130, which is marked as a good value. The Fitbit is a full-featured fitness tracker aimed at the casual user who might toss a device into a gym bag after a workout. I found its monochrome screen easy to read, but a detailed review of my sleep data required a visit to Fitbit's smartphone app. The first Charge 4 purchased by CR worked fine at the start, but stopped yielding sleep data halfway through. After consulting with Fitbit, I brought another Charge 4, which worked fine. The new Charge 5 has a sleeker case and color screen, but Fitbit says its sleep tracking performance should be similar. Best feature, when it's not monitoring your sleep, the Fitbit doubles as a full-featured fitness tracker with wide user base and plentiful training tips. The biggest drawback? The deeper dive into the Fitbit sleep metrics requires a $10 a month Fitbit premium membership. Best for the gym rat looking for a better slumber. Claim battery life up to 7 days. The Garmin Vivo Smart 4 at $130. When it comes to sleep tracking, it feels like the Vivo Smart 4 can't quite make up its mind. The device tries to be low profile like the Whoop and the Aura, but found its tiny displays more distracting than useful. The Garmin smartphone app focuses mainly on total sleep, but does provide easy-to-follow graphics about sleep stages, while a chart with 7-day sleep averages helped me spot and analyze longer-term sleep patterns. The best feature, replete with an array of fitness tracking functions, the Garmin carries an often-discounted $130 MSRP, one of the lowest in the group. Biggest drawback? I found the narrow silicone band uncomfortable, and it actually irritated my skin, which may be a problem for some people. Best for the value-conscious sleep nerd. Claim battery life up to 7 days. Muse 5S Headband Generation 1, $350. The headband-mounted Muse is in many ways the most ambitious sleep monitor device I evaluated. It measures sleep stages directly using electrical activity, similar to sophisticated brainwave monitors in sleep labs. Unfortunately, the execution was lacking. I found that it was uncomfortable and sometimes took a half hour to get and keep a solid connection. I also often awoke with the device askew. Muse explained that my connection issue was caused by a since rectified production problem. I did find that the second Muse S worked somewhat better. Note the Muse S has been replaced with a slightly modified 2.0 version. Best feature, meditation and mindfulness scripts on the app might help you relax. Biggest drawback, unlike the other devices I evaluated, the Muse is a sleep monitoring monotasker, so it's not something that you'd wear outside of bed. Best for a serious student of sleep stages, who has a lot of patience. Claim battery life, 10 hours. Aurora Ring for $300, and this is the editor's choice. The titanium Dura, which looks like a big wedding ring, lacks the wow funker of trackers with flashy displays. It doesn't even tell you if it's charged, but its low-key personality makes it a genial everyday companion. In addition to tracking body temperature, movement, respiratory rate, and resting heart rate, the app includes advanced recovery metrics like heart rate variability, which is great for athletes. The new Aurora Ring Gen 3, which wasn't available for my evaluation, has additional body temperature and heart rate sensors and can measure blood oxygen levels. The best feature, in addition to abundant sleep data, the Aura app offers actionable advice based on your sleep history. The amount of deep sleep was on the low side. Can you make sleep a priority tonight? Biggest drawback. Aura now requires a $6 monthly membership for full access to the app's sleep data. Best for anyone who's made a long-term commitment to understanding sleep. Claim battery life, 4 to 7 days. The Whoop 3.0 Strap, free, with a $30 a month membership fee. The Whoop Strap, endorsed by some professional athletes, sees sleep as a performance metric. It makes concrete and useful training suggestions based in part on your sleep patterns. The device is minimalist. A nylon wrist strap with a prominent buckle that houses the sensors and recharging battery, a simple LED battery level indicator, and no display. I found the strap to be scratchy, and recharging was surprisingly fussy. The smartphone app is robust, but a bit hard to read. Note, Whoop has since introduced a Whoop 4.0, which has a slightly smaller strap and additional sensors. Best feature, the Whoop's 5-day battery life was commendable. Biggest drawback, while the Whoop strap is technically free, You get the device when you sign up for a subscription program. The ongoing fees add up quickly. 2 years of membership could total $720. Best for the dedicated athlete in search of a 24/7 recovery coach. Claimed battery life, 5 days. And here's the article from this month's How to Get the Sleep You Really Need. Can't wake up in the morning? Can't fall asleep at night? Wherever it's disrupting your dreams, we can expert advice and new tools to help you get snoozing soundly. Sleep problems are a hallmark of a modern American life, perhaps never more so than recently. Back in 2016, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that 1/3 of Americans were getting too little sleep at night. But then came the stressors of the pandemic, job losses, disrupted schedules, and closed schools, which gets record numbers of Americans up at night or unable to wake up in the morning. As many as 2 in 3 Americans reported getting either too much or too little sleep in a survey from the American Psychological Association in the pandemic's second year. Though some parts of life are now returning to normal, the insomnia of the past 2 years may be stubbornly hanging on. Many people continue having more trouble falling asleep or staying asleep and have seen unusual shifts in their sleep schedules. All of this is taking a toll. These different types of sleep changes seem to be closely related to problems with mental health, says Carrion Dion, a graduate student in clinical psychology at the University of Ottawa. Research she co-authored, published in the Journal of Sleep Research in 2021, found worse symptoms of stress, anxiety, and depression among those who are sleeping less or going to bed later and waking up later than before. Researchers have long known that anxiety and depression can lead to sleeplessness, while sleeping poorly can increase the likelihood of anxiety and depression. But a good night's rest is also critical for a strong immune system, as well as for health overall. Insufficient sleep over time is associated with a greater risk for diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. It can lead to memory and cognitive issues as well. So how can we get the sleep you need? It's not easy just to flip a switch and start sleeping soundly again, if you ever did in the first place. Here's how to solve 7 common problems that can interfere with the rest of your health. Problem: I often wake up in the middle of the night or early in the morning and can't get back to sleep. Solution: if light coming into your bedroom is the issue, light blocking products like blackout curtains or a sleep mask may do the trick. You might also want to cut back or cut out caffeine, which can keep you perky long after you've consumed it, and alcohol, which can interfere with deep sleep. Many people, however, sleep lightly due to hypervigilance, says Raphael Paleo, MD, a clinical professor at Stanford University's Division of Sleep Medicine, and the author of How to Sleep, the newest science-based solutions for sleeping through the night. In this context, hypervigilance refers to focusing too much on what might disrupt your slumber before you doze off, and even while you're sleeping. This leads to an acute awareness of your environment, and paradoxically can make it harder to sleep. The best way to address this is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, known as CBT-1. CBTI. The I stands for insomnia, for which is often the go-to treatment. CBTI offers techniques that can help you identify and modify thinking patterns and habits to keep you from sleeping. For example, people who spend 9 hours in bed at night but only 6 hours sleeping might be instructed to lessen their in-bed time by 2.5 hours for a week. If that cuts down on unwanted wake-ups, they may slowly add back in-bed hours. Though you can ask a sleep doctor about CBTI, you can also learn to do it on your own, too. Paleo says consider an app like CBTI Coach, which Stanford University developed in collaboration with the federal government. The app's makers say it's not a replacement for therapy. You can also teach yourself strategies to employ when you can't fall back asleep, such as taking some slow, deep breaths, aiming for about 6 breaths per minute. The problem: nature always calls in the middle of the night, often multiple times. Solution: waking up once during the night to use the bathroom is completely normal, says Abigail Mailer, MD, an assistant clinical professor of pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine at UCLA. But if you find you awaken 2 or more times each night for restroom visits, try reducing the salt in your diet, Mailer suggests, because excess sodium, which your kidneys will try to flush out, can contribute. You may also want to avoid fluids in the 2 hours before bed, while making sure you hydrate well during the day. If these steps have little effect, consult your doctor. The awakenings may be a simple underlying issue, such as a sleep disorder or diabetes, says Mahler. The good news is that treating the root medical problem may reduce your middle-of-the-night bathroom trips as well. When I get into bed, my mind races and it takes me too long to fall asleep. Solution: lying in bed with your bedroom dark, quiet, and a comfortable temperature, try a short relaxation exercise, like tensing and then relaxing groups of muscles, starting your feet and finishing with your neck and face. This may reduce physical tension in the body and help short-circuit thoughts that can interfere with sleep, according to the National Institute of Health. If you've been in bed for a while and still can't nod off, go to another room and do a calming activity, rather than lying there watching the minutes tick by. Wait until you feel sleepy again before returning to your bedroom. Longer term, have a plan for heading off for nighttime fretting. Before getting under the covers, make a habit of writing down the next day's task, rather than holding it all in your head. One small 2018 study found that people who spent 5 minutes creating a to-do list before bed fell asleep faster than a control group. It also helps to establish a consistent bedtime and wake time, so your body gets used to falling asleep when you need it to. And avoid all screens for at least half an hour before bed. In the few hours before you turn away from your TV and phone, consider shielding your eyes from their glow by using blue light blocking glasses or an Aflac F.Lux or Night Shift. Blue light suppresses your body's production of melatonin, a hormone that helps signal to your brain that it's time to sleep. When to see a sleep expert? If you have consistent sleep issues that interfere with your daily life, tell your doctor, who may refer you to a sleep specialist. If the doctor suspects issues like sleep-disordered breathing, such as obstruction sleep apnea, or narcolepsy, daytime episodes of falling asleep suddenly, idiopathic hypersomnia, excessive daytime sleepiness, or periodic limb movement disorder, repetitive leg and foot movement during sleep, they are likely to advise an overnight sleep study for a definite diagnosis. These studies usually take place at specially designed sleep centers where you have your own room and bathroom. As you sleep, technicians will typically record your brain waves, heart rate, breathing, blood oxygen levels, snoring, eye and leg movements, and more. In the case of suspected narcolepsy or hypersomnia, you'll also spend some daytime hours at the center, says Abigail Mahler, MD, a sleep specialist at UCLA. For sleep apnea, you may be able to do an at-home overnight study with equipment lent to you. Note, this popular option is prone to false negatives and may require follow-ups. Insurance for sleep studies can vary, so check first. And if you're simply interested in learning more about how you sleep, consider a smartwatch like the Apple Watch Series 6, bottle picture on the cover, or fitness tracker with sleep tracking abilities, which we just talked about. Isn't that convenient? I get at least 7 hours of sleep, go me, and still wake up exhausted. Expert groups like the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommended that most adults get 7 hours of sleep a night. So if you're getting only 7 hours, stop by upping that to 8 or even 9. Next, figure out whether you're sleepy or fatigued. Sleepiest means you feel drowsy and have a hard time staying awake, Mahler says. Fatigue, in which you feel tired but don't find staying awake difficult, is a symptom of many illnesses, including anemia, thyroid disease, and depression, that may not directly relate to sleep. Discuss ongoing fatigue with your primary care provider, Mahler and Paleo suggest, and if you're constantly sleepy, ask for a referral to a sleep specialist. It could be a sign of some form of sleep apnea, in which breathing stops and starts during sleep. The doctor may also test you for other sleep disorders that leave you exhausted after a good night's rest. In addition, bruxism, clenching or grinding your teeth during sleep, can get in the way of rest. Headaches and jaw pain in the morning are telltale signs. A dentist can check your teeth for wear and fit you with a mouth guard that may help. Problem: I always fall asleep in the living room after dinner, wake up, and then can't fall asleep again at bedtime. Brief naps are not necessarily a problem, especially if you take them after lunch and before dinner. But nodding off on the couch in the evening and then finally wide awake when you get into bed is a typical pattern in chronic insomnia. If you can't resist the lure of a company couch, doing something active at the time like taking a walk may keep you from dozing off. But you may also need to reset your circadian rhythm. Here's how. Get up at the same time each day and make sure to get some sunlight each morning. If you can't do this, you might want to ask your doctor about trying a light therapy device. The problem: my partner's loud snoring and tossing and turning keeps me awake. Allergies, congestion, or deviated septum can all cause snoring. But routine snoring can also be a sign of obstructive sleep apnea, in which the physical obstruction in the throat, often the tongue, interferes with breathing during sleep. This can have serious health consequences, like a higher risk of stroke. Symptoms can also include daytime sleepiness, high blood pressure, and night sweats. Helping your partner get to the root of their snoring will enable you to sleep, and Paleo says you may save their life, so urge them to see a doctor. The most common treatment for OSA is continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP machine, which sends a constant flow of air into your airway through the mask and tube attachments worn during sleep. It is often at least partially covered by insurance. These are once uniformly noisy and bulky, but many owner CPAPs are far sleeker, smaller, and quieter. Once a CPAP user gets used to the device and settles a mask that fits properly, which can take a few tries, snoring should completely stop. If not, adjustments to the device can help. If your partner moves around a lot and it's ruining your sleep, consider whether it's time for a new mattress. In CR's test, mattresses are tested for stabilization or bounciness, a measure of the likelihood that movement on one side of the bed will disturb someone on the other side. Consider trying mattresses together in a store to see how they feel when you move around, suggests Chris Reagan, project leader for CR's mattress testing. Problem: I work irregular hours, which makes it hard to sleep when I need to. Solution: sleep issues are common among overnight workers and those with inconsistent schedules, going in, say, at 10 a.m. one day and 7 a.m. the next. If you need to sleep during the day so that you can work at night, keep your bedroom as dark as possible. Blackout curtains are a must. Strategic napping, timing naps for maximum benefit, can help too, says Mahler. For overnight workers, a nap right before a shift or even during, if it's permitted, may boost alertness and performance. Limit these naps to 60 minutes or less to reduce the chance you'll enter deep sleep. Waking from deep sleep can be associated with grogginess and disorientation, says Mahler. You may want to consult with a sleep specialist to figure out what nap time would help you most, based on your schedule. And though it may not be for everyone, modafinil, Provigil, is a prescription wake-promoting medication approved by the Food and Drug Administration for shift workers, sleep disorder, and some other issues. Now, there are several additional parts of this article, which we'll finish next week since we don't really have enough time to do it now. And we'll go over in detail what they talk about. They talk about supplements and things like that. And since we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest Consumer Reports, be sure to listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservices.service.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thank you so very, very much for listening.